The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
A warning that our next conversation is not for little ears and may be triggering for some. Hazel Bean was just 20 years old when her life changed forever. What started off as a summer working abroad in Portugal as a holiday rep turned into a nightmare. One night after work, returning to her apartment in Praia da Rocha, she was violently attacked by a masked intruder while asleep. The Portuguese police failed to find that intruder. But that man is the prime suspect in the Madeleine McCann case. His name is Christian Bruckner. He's currently in prison for raping a 72-year-old woman in Praia da Luz in 2005, but he's due for release in September of this year. Hazel Bean's case was revived years later when, reading a description of the suspect in the Madeleine McCann case, Hazel decided to waive her anonymity and helped the British police in their investigation into the disappearance of the three-year-old 18 years ago. As a result of Hazel's actions, Bruckner was indicted in the German courts, but eventually acquitted on Hazel's rape charge and on other similar charges. But he remains a suspect in the Madeleine McCann case, and it's thought that materials found on Bruckner's property gave rise to the recent searches in Portugal. Now, as you may have read in Stephen Breen's recent fascinating interview in the Irish Sun, Hazel is still in fear of Bruckner, and Hazel joins me now. Hazel, good morning and welcome.
Morning, Pat.
Can you tell us how your whole experience with this man started?
Yeah, so I was working and living in Praia da Rocha in Portugal.
And what brought you there?
I was working for an Irish travel company at the time. I went to work as a kiddie rep and a transfer rep. So as part of that, they provided you accommodation. And the accommodation I was given was in the hotel where I worked. It was a huge, big complex that spread across either side of the road. And I was on one side of the road, obviously. And I lived there on my own because my work partner was male. They wouldn't house us in the same apartment. So we lived directly next door.
Was it kind of the job of your dreams? Did you enjoy it?
I loved it. Yeah. No, I absolutely adored the job. And I loved more the life. It was really hard work. Like, it was 18-hour days. It wasn't at all what it's portrayed to be on the TV on certain shows. It's tough, tough work and a lot of responsibility. You're looking after people's children, obviously. And the airport transfers can be very tricky to kind of get everyone in one spot. But no, I loved it. Job of my dreams? I don't know. I wanted to travel. It was a compromise with my parents. They didn't want me going off backpacking by myself. And I had worked with this company previously in the year before in Mallorca in Spain. Because they provide you accommodation, you know, your flights, if anything was to happen, your parents can come out, all these, and you have a wage every week.
Sure.
Very little, but you still have a wage. So it was like a compromise. They were happy to see me go and experience and travel. So I suppose my dream job was to travel.
Okay, yeah. But this was the halfway house.
This was the halfway house. This was me being safer as they were, you know, for
now,
them.
Now, did you feel safe living on your own across the road from the major complex? Did you feel safe?
You know, that's a hard one to answer because I come from a really busy house. I'm the eldest of five. Our key was left in the hall door. You know, there was kids in and out all the time, friends, my brother's friends, football teams, the whole lot. So when I had first lived in Mallorca, it was fine because I lived with somebody. It was another girl. And I didn't feel unsafe at all. But when I first moved to Portugal and I was by myself, it was the quiet. Yeah, and just the loneliness of being by yourself. I found that personally very difficult. I didn't feel unsafe in the complex, if that makes sense. Yeah. But I just felt unsettled in myself because it was something very new for me.
So normally in your household, if you go to bed, there'd still be a clamour coming and going.
Oh, yeah.
Doors
so even now at 42 nearly, I sleep better with the noise. I sleep better with the radio on or, you know, like I'm just so used to that. And so it took a long time for me to kind of get used to, you know, the hum of the fridge. The fridge would make a noise, then the toaster would rattle. So you kind of got used to living by yourself, essentially, yeah.
Now, had you any contact or sight of Christian Bruckner before he attacked you?
Never, no. Not that never.
So what happened?
So that night in particular, like every night really, I had a boyfriend at the time and he worked in a bar that was essentially in the car park nearly of the hotel where I worked and was in block 1 and 2. So after work, I finished work maybe around 10 o'clock. I used to do the kiddies entertainment at night and I went around there. And this night in particular stuck out in a sense because himself and the owner of the pub were having a bit of a arguing with each other. And I wasn't having any of it, really, to be honest. So I sat on the steps outside the bar with some of the staff there, and we were yapping away. And eventually I said to him, I'm going to go. We need to leave this, like, stop fighting. And he told me to F off. So I did. And for the first time ever in the time that I was there, I walked home alone. Like, I went home alone. And just to say, like, when I walked home alone, I didn't, you know, not that it would make any difference, I didn't go down back alleyways by myself for miles. Yeah. I literally walked across the road. To get across the road, you had to go over a small little footbridge. So that's what I did. I walked over the footbridge and straight into the main reception of Block 3, where I lived, went to my room, felt a bit sorry for myself because I'd had a bit of an argument with my boyfriend. I was 20, you know, my world was over. And I lay in the bed and I obviously fell asleep. I was still fully dressed and I fell asleep. And the next thing that I remember, or the next thing that came to me, was him calling my name, waking me up. Just to kind of give a small backtrack of that, the balcony door on my apartment had been broken from the time that I was living in it, and I'd complained about it. So it wasn't a case of having to break into it.
Okay,
it
but would just open. You came in through the front door of your
apartment and locked
that door as normal.
Yeah, came in through that. And them doors, they were key doors. They weren't like now with the, you know, the electric kind of like cards. It was a key door, and you couldn't get into it without a key from the front door. So, as I said, I was woke by somebody calling my name. And in that moment, it's very, very difficult to explain because it sounds so much longer than it was. You're talking milliseconds. You know, these thoughts start going through your head all before you even open your eyes. It's like, who is it? Like, is it my boyfriend? Is he coming to say sorry? He couldn't get in. How, you know, all these things.
Yeah. And if it's a stranger, how does he know my name?
Yeah. So I think even in that mad moment, because I was being called by my name, before I even open my eyes, there's an automatic assumption that this person knows who I am, do you know? But I knew that my boyfriend couldn't get in. Nobody could get in the door, like, of the apartment. So, again, before I even open my eyes, it's this fear that it's very difficult to describe. It's like every ounce of blood just rushes to your feet. Essentially, you're kind of, well, I was anyway, I was nearly paralysed. You know, you're just completely frozen. So I was asleep on my stomach and I turned my head to see who this was calling me. And yeah, so that's when I was greeted with this tall figure of a man, all dressed in black, wearing a mask, and he was holding a knife.
And then you were raped?
Yeah, three times.
When you went to the police, and you did... immediately? I mean, was it the next morning or immediately that night?
No, the police, when I had eventually got out of the apartment, I went straight to the reception of the hotel and they
called. Did he leave by the same way he came in?
He went out the balcony door. He stepped backwards out the balcony door into his shoes. So he had taken it, he had no shoes on while he was there.
So down to reception, called the police?
Yes, they called the police. And within, like, it was very quick, to be fair, the police. Lots of male police arrived. And in that same breath, the first call that I had made myself, the only number I could remember was my dad's landline. So in that space of time, my dad had, I'd spoken to him. He had got off the phone to ring my then boyfriend to get him to come to the hotel to see how I was. So he arrived as well. At that moment, look, this probably sounds very childish, but I was kind of reared, and I'm sure a lot of people would have been, that the police are there to take care of you. So, you know, I often got lost as a kid in town at Christmas, and your mum would always say, "Now look for the Gardaí and they'll find me if you get lost." So when I seen the police come in, there was like this, I wouldn't say I relaxed because, you know, of the situation, but there was this sense of, oh God, I'm okay now. Do you know that somebody's going to come and mind me? But unfortunately, like, that really genuinely wasn't the case. They didn't speak English to me at all. They just were talking over me in Portuguese, and I couldn't quite catch anything that was being said. But they were quite insistent that I went back to the apartment straight away. And I even remember, like, vividly at that time saying, "This, I am not going back down to that room." Like, I know it's very hard for people to understand, and I genuinely don't want anyone to ever have to understand what I felt in that moment. But the fear that's still, like, very, very raw and real inside you. I didn't know if he was still down there. I didn't know anything. So this person, I just didn't want to go back there. But they were quite insistent. And they made me go back to the apartment that morning. So we went down to its hallway corridor, you know, as most blocks of apartments. And my apartment was at the very end. We went down and they were in and out, loads of different policemen in and out. They stood me in the doorway of the room or of the apartment, and I had to strip off in front of all of them for them to take photographs of the injuries that I had. Like, there was no privacy, there was no female, there was no one speaking English. They kind of just, you know, told, like, verb or it suggested what I had to do, you know, told, and I really, really didn't want to do it. But you're kind of just the shell of a person at that stage that, you know, I wish I was how I am now then.
More assertive.
Yeah. And I didn't have anything left. Everything that I had had been genuinely put into just surviving what had happened in that room. So I did what I was told to do. I stripped off. They took photographs. I put back on the clothes that had been given to me. They were my boyfriend's, the boot of his car. And I was put into an ambulance and taken to the local hospital, Portimao Hospital. Nobody was allowed to accompany me to the hospital, so my boyfriend drove. My boss at the time met us there at the hospital, and they weren't even allowed in past the reception area of the hospital, so I had to go in alone. I was taken to an examination room where I know now what, you know, the kit that they do. They obviously done that, drew blood, done all these different tests. They noted different injuries that I had and cleaned me up as best they could. So I was taken back out and there was nobody. Like, there was no police officer, there was no...
That was it, high and dry, left alone.
Oh, 100%, like literally nobody. I had no clue. Like, and I suppose just to put it in context, like, I was 20, I was in a foreign country, I didn't speak the language, I had no mammy's house to go to, you know, I had nobody. I literally had nothing. I had no clothes, I had no phone, no money, no passport, nothing. Everything that I owned in Portugal was in that room, in that apartment. So yeah, that was a pretty difficult time. Like, I didn't even get a business card to say, call this number and we'll give you a dig out, like nothing.
So how then did the investigation continue?
Very strangely, in my opinion, even at the time, I just couldn't understand. I was given an appointment card to come to Portimao Police Station. You'll see it a lot on the TV, where, you know, it's the same police station that, you know, the likes of the McCanns would have went to. And again, nobody was allowed to come in with me. My mum had arrived in Portugal at that stage. And just before that, 4 days after what happened, I had been given permission to go back into the apartment to get my things, like to actually get my stuff. So my mum came with me. And when we got in, the apartment was just as I'd left it. Like, there was blood on the floor, bloodstained sheets in the bed. Everything still remained as it was. So my mum, God bless her, she tried to kind of cover, move the sheet so I didn't have to look at it, you know. And when she did, my fingernails were still in the bed. So they clearly didn't collect anything from the room. My bags had already been pre-packed, so somebody had been in there packing up my things. So yeah, fast forward to the 8 days later, I was never provided with a translator or, you know, or anything like that. But I was given this appointment card to go to Portimao, and I did. My mum wasn't allowed to enter the building, literally not allowed in the front door of the building. So she had to go to a little coffee shop a couple of doors up and sit and wait while I went in to give what I believed at the time to be a statement. I had taken this friend of mine with me. He was a bar manager who was Portuguese but had been married to an Irish woman, so spoke English, just to help me, because I didn't know what was going on at all and obviously didn't understand the language barrier. So they took me up to this very open office. It was just a big, huge room with, you know, desks with the partitions. One of the policemen there had his feet up on the table. I have signs on. I didn't know at the time. The friend that I'd taken with me knew these police officers, and they were all like clapping each other on the back and, you know, laughing and joking. And again, I remember just sitting there. I didn't know what was going on. And they slid an evidence bag across the table to me and asked me if they were my clothes. And I said, well, yeah, you got them in my room. They are mine. They asked me to give details of what had happened. I told them what I've said every day since then, that, you know, this person who had came into my room, was he was about 6 foot tall. He was fair haired. I could see his eyebrows. So I knew that he had fair or blonde hair. He had really, really blue eyes. He was very slim build, but lean, not skinny, you know, not scrawny. And he had a mark on his leg. I didn't know, I still don't know to this day what that mark was. But I knew I could see something. I kept trying to catch it, you know, to see if I could. But he was wearing like women's tights. So, they were thick enough that you knew there was something there, but you actually couldn't make out exactly what it was. I told them he was German. He spoke English with a German accent, and they told me I wasn't allowed to say that. And I challenged that because I was really, I knew that he was German. And they said, no, you have to say he's Germanic. And I'd never heard of that term before. And I said, no, I can't say something. I don't even understand what it means. You know, no, he was German. So that essentially was it. My mom even would recall, like, it took for me to give whatever information that they were looking for at that stage, the length it took her to drink a cup of coffee, because I was back out. And that's literally the last of any kind of formal interaction I ever had with the police in Portugal. They followed me for a while, and I started to recognise who they were. So I approached them on a number of occasions. You know, they had told me I'd be better off going home, that I would destroy the tourism in the area, that I would bring it down, that my friends essentially might lose their jobs if there was, you know, no work for them. They told me they were following me to see if I essentially initiated something like this myself, that I don't use bad language on the show, but to see if I was an SLUT. They wanted to see if that was kind of how I behaved. Not that that would make any difference anyway, but they really tried their best just to kind of get me to leave, go home, and they don't have to do anything. But that's essentially all that was done, and that was highlighted very clearly last year.
Yeah. How did Christian Bruckner come into the frame then, identifiably?
Yeah. So in 2020, it was actually the 3rd of June. I remember it well because it was my brother's birthday, and we were obviously in the midst of COVID. I was working from home and homeschooling and cooking for old age people in my area. So it was a really busy day. And one of my brothers had sent a text into our family WhatsApp group for a link for an RTE article. And you know, you can see the thumbnail before you actually even open it. And I could see that it was about Madeleine McCann. And again, with the greatest respect, I kind of seen that. I said, can't be dealing with this now. I've too much going on. I had a really, really busy day. So it was like about around 10 o'clock that night. Again, I actually sat down, got the kids to bed and whatever, and opened it to read it. And he has told me since that he was like pacing, peppering, waiting for me to open this message. But he didn't want to kind of ring me in case, you know, and drag up stuff. So I did anyway. And in that article itself, there was no photograph of this person. There was just a description. And it was exactly the description that I would have given to the police. And I think that's obviously what my brother had read. And, you know, so being human, I looked more, and I hadn't realised at that time that this was like huge in the news world. I was totally oblivious to it. Like, and they had put out this appeal, Operation Grange, who are, you know, the Met in London, they had put out this appeal looking for more information on this person. I hadn't had a notion of it. So it was through one of the other articles that I'd actually seen his photograph. And then that was it.
That was it. We'll pause there. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll resume this extraordinary story after the break.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
I'm in conversation with Hazel Behan, and we are talking about Christian Bruckner, who, after a breakthrough in the Madeleine McCann case, enabled Hazel to recognise the man who had raped her. Hazel, so we now know who is in the frame for your rape many years before.
Yeah.
What happened next?
So it's kind of a bit of a whirlwind then, to be honest, because I had obviously highlighted myself then to Operation Grange. I sent them a very, very brief email. Like, you know, obviously this is something very sensitive and important to me, so I wasn't going to divulge everything in an email to a bunch of strangers. So they had on one of the appeals set out, you know, a phone number or an email address to contact. So I said email them would be best. And they literally contacted me first thing the next morning. They were so lovely to me, actually. They were really, really nice. And again, very briefly, it was just over the phone, but very, carefully, they asked a few questions, and obviously I've learned since that they were aware of my case following the conviction of Christian Bruckner for the rape and assault of the 72-year-old lady and the similarities that that were there. Again, I didn't know anything about this lady's case at all until a long time after. But so yeah, from there I was essentially transferred to the BKA in Germany. They would be the German equivalent of the FBI, I suppose. And it went from there through all the legal channels. Things take so long when you're dealing with, like, you're talking Ireland, England, Germany and Portugal, four different European states at the time, you know, having to work alongside each other just for me to give an actual statement. So eventually I did, with two lovely Gardaí here in Ireland, under the kind of guidance of the German authorities. And that took about 3 days. So I know what I gave in Portugal wasn't a statement. And that was extremely difficult. Yeah, it was very difficult having to go back. And you're not just going back, you actually have to really, really relive the moment to give, you know, a genuine account of your memory of what had happened. I say lucky very loosely, but I was very lucky that, you know, this was, I recall everything.
Yeah.
An awful lot more of it actually than I had realised based on the line of question. They're obviously professional in what they do and they ask certain questions to make you, you know, remember a bit more. And my statement was sent to Germany through Interpol or one of them people. And then I was taken to Germany to do it again. Essentially, I had to do my statement to them through a translator in German. And the next 3.5 years were horrendous, to be quite honest, because it's like a drippy tap. It's just, you're literally, it's drip, drip, drip. And at that time, I hadn't engaged with literally anybody, media or outside, nothing.
And were you aware that they were heading for a trial of this man for?
Eventually I was. Obviously they had to investigate. And what happens in Germany, it's very different legal system to here. Not that I have huge experience of Irish law either, but from what you read in the papers or whatever, it is very different. So they have what's called a chamber. I would liken it maybe to our DPP, very similar setup. And this chamber is made up of lay judges and solicitors and people of, you know, that kind of area of expertise. And they essentially determine whether or not a case will get to court. There is no jury in cases like this in Germany. So you have members of the chamber are your judges. So you have five judges. You have one main judge and four lay judges, they're called. And they essentially are the people who make the decisions in a trial. So eventually, you know, like no different to lots of other cases here in Ireland and everywhere else, it was set for this and then it was put back. It was set, it was put back. So your life is like pause, play for years, like, you know, and eventually it was locked in and I had to travel to Germany to testify in Braunschweig in court. I wasn't allowed initially to have anybody accompany me, but I don't stay alone anywhere and haven't done in 21 years almost. So there was a bit of a battle. Do I take my mom or do I take my husband? And we realised, or we came, sorry, to the conclusion that it would be better for the kids if daddy was there and, you know, the sameness is there. So mom came with me. And I know it's, you know, it knocked the stuffing out of her a bit, the whole process of it. It's very difficult, even though she wasn't allowed in the actual courtroom. It's very intense.
Now, when it came to the trial, the evidence, your statement and the forensics, I mean, had the Portuguese done anything of their job correctly to enable a successful conviction?
No, is the short answer there. I mean, the judgment was made in the case. And just to say, it's my case and there was four others. We were all trialled together. So he was acquitted on the five cases, not just on mine. And all of these cases were investigated by the same Portuguese police team in the same jurisdiction, the same, you know, every one of them was investigated by the same team.
Those sloppy ones, sloppy five times.
And it's the same team who would have looked after the Madeleine McCann case as well. So yeah, I received, obviously the judgment was made in October, just gone, in 2024, but we didn't actually receive the written judgment until January, just gone. And eventually when I got it translated and, you know, all that kind of stuff, the judge actually says more than once, like a good few times in it, that the reasoning behind the acquittal, in her, you know, professional opinion, is based on poor investigation from the Portuguese part. I have to say, for the German police force, I couldn't credit them enough. And I think, you know, it kind of is missed a little bit sometimes, because they're dealing with historical cases that were very poorly investigated at that time anyway. So it's not as if they have this huge bag of evidence to work from. They're going back to people essentially 16, 17, 18 years after something has happened. Do you remember where you were on the 16th of June 2004? I do. But the majority of people aren't going to, like, they're just not. So, you know, they really have worked tirelessly in all of our cases, not just mine, to get answers, because they firmly believe, and look, he's been convicted of horrendous crimes already, you know, in a court. So he's known to them as a very dangerous person.
Now, do you fear him? I mean, do you think that he might, if he will be released, mm-hmm. unless they find something else to convict him of, he will be released in the coming months. Do you fear him?
Yeah, of course I do. Yeah, like,
I mean, because you've had your case before a court, mm-hmm. and in a sense, there's nothing more you can do to him, because you've tried to get him convicted. Mm. So there's nothing more. So,
you know, he's a person who we know, you know, and it has been proven, has committed horrendous crimes across Europe, essentially, for many years, and always went under the radar, always dodged the charge or dodged this. So he's schooled as such, and he's very clever in how he can manipulate a system. He has lived off grid, under the radar, that for so many years that a leopard doesn't change his spots. I wouldn't be surprised if he went straight back to committing crimes.
Finally, Hazel, you're not letting it rest.
No.
What are you doing now?
At this moment, obviously, there's an appeal against the prosecution in Germany, have appealed the decision made for me and the other cases. So that's a waiting game. I don't know when that will happen. We were told about 12 months. So hopefully we'll get a decision soon enough. And for me personally, I've, with the help of my wonderful solicitor, Dara Macken, we have lodged a case with the European Court of Human Rights to essentially hold the Portuguese police to account for what they didn't do. And I suppose, you know, I've been asked a few times what I hope for from that. And the truth is, I just want them to do better. That's it. I mean, I'm not the first, and I certainly won't be the last woman or person to be a victim of a crime like this abroad. Whether you're working away or on holidays or on a hen weekend with your pals, and if something horrendous happens like that, I would like for the Portuguese police, but all police, to treat victims like that with the bare minimum, provide a translator, give them a safe place to stay, ensure they have, you know, their basic needs are met, because that just didn't happen for me, and it really, really impacted my life afterwards.
Hopefully they'll do better by future victims, because inevitably there will be future victims.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Hazel Behan, thank you very much for joining us in studio today.
Thank you.
And if you've been affected by anything mentioned in the interview, you can contact the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre National Helpline, 1-800-77-888.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.